Well, that's sort of a theme song. Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. I'm not really sure. I mean, it is, but, you know, what I mean is I wasn't really sure how to proceed, and so I didn't know if every episode of All About Aesthetics, which this is, for Journey of an Aesthete podcast, I'm Mitch Hampton, your host anyhow. When I do this theme, which I call Bob Fosse, what am I going to do with it? By which I mean, okay, do I just play the piano work and so give you the network television retro version, which would be 40 seconds, right? 40, something like that. Maybe 1 minute. But it's a piano work. It has movements. It's supposed to be, I think, 11 minutes long. So what am I to do? Do I condense? I don't know. So I think it'd be fun just to spend, you know, I'm at the piano. I'm going to spend a little time here. Maybe composing live right now. So let's see. So let's, so there's different things you could do with the theme. So the idea is this, you know. Very impressionistic. What's that from? Theater fans will know that's Chicago, Candor and Ebb. I mean, it's not literally the melody, but it's the, you know, it's the raw material that John Cannon and Fred Ebb wrote for Bob Fosse for not the first thing I play, but that, you know, that's, you know, that's the, you know, all that jazz thing. So I thought it'd be interesting to write a classical piano work. I'm always doing this kind of stuff. That's my hard listening concept, which is the 10-year anniversary this year of that, 2013 now. Taking, you know, elements from the entertainment commercial world, musically, elements from bebop, the jazz world, some rock and roll, Hollywood, Broadway, those kinds of stylistic, you know, elements in music, and trying to create contemporary concert classical piano music out of those elements. That's the best way. I don't know how else to describe it. But I've been working in this for 10 years, my 10th year, and this is going to be something, this Bob Fosse. And I'm just going to give you a little taste, and, you know, of course, I could sit here for a long time and get into all that, but I won't, because we have a lot to get to today, aesthetics. So this is a really interesting thing. I'm going to get my TV ready. Let's see here. It's a really interesting thing. To be a human being at this moment in history. This is god awful, these things, they just, come on, let's go. There we go. Is it going to play?
Jesus. Our graduation.
There we go. To be a human being at this moment in history, because we're in a moment of history in which all the preceding stuff, raw material. I was talking about when I compose music, I use raw material. I use entire musical languages. I mean, raw material is maybe a little bit of a misnomer as a phrase, because it implies that the stuff I'm using is small or is just a scrap, but it isn't. It's raw. So it's sort of like, I don't know. It's like raw material. It's like clay. It's like, and I'm molding and creating a composition, but the elements that I'm using are themselves entire universes. You remember I did an episode recently where I talked about studying Bach's chorale, the SATB, soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and we spent an entire year with Robert DiDomenica studying Schoenberg's study of Bach. So you're getting Bach, but you're getting it through Schoenberg's, Arnold Schoenberg, admittedly idiosyncratic, I won't say perverse, but peculiar interpretation and theory of harmony. So you're getting two great minds. You're getting Bach and Schoenberg when you study that text. But the thing of it is, we did the entire year. So an entire year of just four voices. That could be like raw material if you wanted to write that way. You know. And so these are all aesthetic concerns, just like this strange TV show we're looking at here. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about what I'm wearing, as I always do. So this is a suit in what we call a worsted fabric. It's a very, very lightweight form of that fabric that some people call bird's eye. And it's a weave. And it's an actual suit in that the coat or jacket matches the trouser. Look what we have here, though. It's not the same cloth, but it's sort of what we call the same weave. It's another bird's eye. So I'm going to stand up. See this? I don't know if you can. There we go. These are shoes. Call them two-tone shoes, I guess. That the woman who made these shoes for me called me up last night. And I haven't talked to her in like 5 years. I think the last time I talked to her is when she delivered the shoes to me. One of the very few pieces of handmade, custom, bespoke articles of anything that I have, actually. I don't have that many. I have actually rather small wardrobe, actually. We could talk about that, how I make a tiny wardrobe look big. But this is one of the few things that's like made by hand by this woman, Jessie Moore. And Jessie Moore is having an exhibit, an art exhibit of her creations, boots and shoes, in North Carolina, in a town called Penland. It's an hour away from Asheville, and they have a craft school there. I've never been there, Penland Gallery and Craft. And it's really beautiful. She said, Mitch, look at these boots. And so I'm trying to see if I can show. Again, this derailed my whole program because I had this whole thing planned of Howard Hawks and Marilyn Monroe and Price is Right and What's My Line and Gene Shrimpton and aesthetics and depiction. I had this whole thing in semicon. And all that I put, even though that I planned many weeks, I'm going to get to some of that in this episode, don't worry. But I had to see, you have to take things as they come. This is important too. So what do we got here? So, all right. Here we go. This is the Penland School of Craft. Okay. And this is Jessie Moore's shoes. I hope you can see these. Those are kind of formal black shoes, and there's some saying on there. There's like little sayings and writings and wanes, and we had a long conversation today, actually, about her relationship to Rene Magritte and how one of these boots is inspired by her journey with Magritte. and she originally disliked Magritte, eventually came to understand the greatness of Magritte without finally even liking Magritte. It's complex. So actually, her mind's sort of like mine, these important distinctions. Or as Isaiah Berlin says, one thing is not another thing. So what she meant by that is that she initially had some reservations or disagreement with Magritte. And then she started making shoes with Wayne's on them. She came to Magritte. But that's, and then she also told me that she read Moby Dick finally after trying to read it 10 times, 11 times. So I only mentioned Jessie Moore because she's a shoemaker. She made these shoes, and we spontaneously started talking about what it is to like something or dislike something. What does it mean? Is it possible? Actually, I know it's possible. It's a real thing to not love something, maybe not even like something, but yet deeply, deeply respect it, which is a kind of a liking. And of course, if you're doing a show like mine, you're going to have all sorts of people on my show. All kinds of people doing all kinds of things. I can't be an expert on all of it. I can't love all of it. I would say all of it has value. And the question, of course, becomes, you know, what makes it valuable? And its value... So value is an interesting thing. So value, if you break it down, there's so many kinds of value. So something can be valuable, because it's just simply well-made and moves you. And I got to tell you, Magritte, not my favorite painter, but Magritte moves people and is well-made. And is clever and is whimsical. And there's all this stuff in his imagination. And that stuff is in the painting. And so there we have it, that even if I'm not a Magritte fan, I've stood in front of Magritte paintings, by the way. I stood in front of a lot of paintings. That's a whole, I mean, I often wanted to write a little book about how I came to love abstraction, because when I was a boy, you know, like 9 or 10 years old, I didn't understand abstraction. I didn't like it. And then painstakingly, day in and day out, year in and year out, I would go to MoMA and the Whitney and stand in front of Franz Kline and de Kooning and Mark Rothko and Barnett Newman, not knowing anything about them, and Jasper Johns. And I put in the time staying in front of their work, and I eventually came to not only get it, but love it. Isn't that interesting? So that's just one example. I don't know. I don't know if this has to do with aesthetics or not. Maybe it does. I guess it does. But it certainly is not what I had planned to talk about today. You know, I want to talk about, what's this? What's my line? Okay, so what I've been dealing with last episode, this episode, is two deeply, intimately intertwined questions that themselves are nevertheless separate from each other. The question of a large worldview. You know, I said recently, I think about, I don't know, we were talking about a particular subject. I don't remember. And I said, I think it was Hannah Arendt. Yeah, that's right. Hannah Arendt, I said, had a point of view. That when you read Life of the Mind or Origins of Totalitarianism, you're entering her world. That world is a universe, which in turn she is reflecting because of your addition and knowledge on, you're reflecting on two things. You're reflecting on her erudition and knowledge of the world, which is considerable. It's better than most folks today. Like I just said, Hannah Arendt knows more about the world than most people walking around today. Good, bad, or indifferent, however bright they are, she's that good, right? So I'll give her that. But not just that, but She creates a world with her syntax and her prose, like a universe. And you, when we read her, we're entering her world. But there's two ways of talking about world. World could be like the era you're in. So this is a world of the 50s. This show is 1967, but make no mistake, it might as well be 1952. It might as well be that nothing's happened. This is all one world. This is the black and white and the, his smile. And we're going to, so I was, for a very small period of time, I was dating a woman who had been a Ford model, the Ford modeling agency, ages and ages ago. And she said something very interesting to me. She said, "Mitch, if you want to understand cultural change, you got to watch this Gene Shrimpton Once My Line." Because she said, Gene Shrimpton is the future, was the future. By which she meant the following 40 years. Not just 67, but 77, 87, 97, 2007. Gene Shrimpton's in a way still relevant. She's still in a way, and I'm trying to speak for somebody else. And again, my apologies, but the gist of it was, she's still in a way relevant. Whereas all these other Bennett Cerf and these Henry Morgan, Jack Jones, even great singer. Love, Jack Jones is a great pop jazz singer, but even he too is less relevant or of the past. So, and she says, if you look at Gene Shrimpton's, Gene Shrimpton was a supermodel, kind of a supermodel of the 60s and 70s and hung out with David Bailey, you know, and Richard Avedon and sort of that world. And so you're seeing in this episode, my friend said, you're seeing the clash of the past and the future. And since I was born in 1967, we're looking at things that were made during the year of my birth. Because it's interesting. And, you know, that's kind of, so let me try to see here what we can talk about here. Prepare you. Emily Ratajkowski is a supermodel now, right? I always mangle her last name, Ratajkowski, Emily. Wrote the book, My Body. Gene Shrimpton was the Emily Ratajkowski of this year. I mean, 67. And let's see. So what's my line? They have to guess who somebody is. It's like, you wear the blindfold, you know, what's, it's like guessing something silly. So, but let's look at this a little bit and...
And Arlene, since we three have been together for those many, many years, if you note a little respect in his voice, will you tell me about it? It's been a great week for me, Bennett. I must say I'm tremendously pleased with my new job. And we also had our graduation at Tilton School up in New Hampshire this weekend. And I made the commencement address, which has a point. He was supposed to make it, but he went to Bangkok and I couldn't get my hands on him. So I had to make the address this week. We're going to do some different things tonight to celebrate this good week. And if you don't mind, will you put your masks on? Because we're going to have two mystery challenges tonight. So mask up.
So already we're getting a lot of information in those few seconds about the world. I'm going to be hyperbolic. The entire culturally known world everywhere, not just American television, of that age. Deportment, elocution, you know, this, you know, interesting. That's a world. And it's interesting that all these four tastemakers, they would have been thought leaders, actually, of that era. Well, the technical term is middle brow. They're neither high nor low. In other words, they're trying to create culture to reach the maximum amount of people. Sometimes today that's called monoculture. It's often, people like to say monoculture is dead or was killed. Everything's a niche marketing. Everything's a subculture. And that's probably true to a certain extent. Although I have, when I see that everybody's watching, everybody's listening to Taylor Swift and everybody watches Oppenheimer, we still have a monoculture. In other words, there's things that everybody kind of gets into. You know, there's even popular music that I like. I don't hate everything that's pop and top 40. In fact, I love 70s disco music, and that at one time was very popular. You know, but I'm sort of half joking, but you take my point. So I want to watch a little bit of this episode and see if my friend was right. She is. I mean, it's interesting. Because she says in this episode, you're seeing the shift. You're basically seeing the 60s and 70s destroy the 40s and 50s here. And it's all nonverbal. It's all Gene Shrimpton.
Immediately, so please. Kinda... Ms. P, it's nice to see you on the panel.
Thank you. May I make a correction of the name of the station I work for?
It's my fault, KGO-TV.
Thank you. My fault. Vice President.
My fault.
Johnny, call me
Henry asked me, and I gave him the wrong advice. It's KGO-TV. Tell Dave Sachs I'm sorry. All righty. Henry, nice to have you with us. You're all blindfolded.
Yes.
You're all blindfolded? All right, let's have our first mystery challenger. Will you enter and sign in, please?
So the contestant comes on and... we got him. Gene Shrimpton. I'm going to pause here. Gene Shrimpton was the Elle McPherson, Cindy Crawford, Emily Reschuskowski, Kate Upton of then. So kind of that kind of... Twiggy.
All right. Panel, as you know, in the case of mystery challenges, we go to the other form of questioning, one question at a time, in turn moving clockwise. And we'll begin things with Bennett, sir.
Well, I'm taking for granted from the whistle that it's a good-looking girl. I'm not even going to ask that question. Is it somebody, are you somebody whose name has appeared in the newspapers within recent weeks?
Yes.
Miss Francis?
Would it be in a place other than the entertainment pages?
Yes.
Mr. Morgan?
Oh, boy. Other than the entertainment pages?
Yes. Now, this does not rule out, I will say to be fair with your permission, that it could be in the entertainment pages, but it could equally be in another section of the paper. Henry?
Would it have anything to do with sports?
No.
One down and nine to go. Pia Lindstrom.
Do you work in any of the performing arts?
Yes.
Mr. Sir?
Have you got anything to do with the world of fashion?
Yes.
Miss Francis?
Well,
oh, I thought maybe...
I thought I was going to... I'm quite sure I know who it is, but I'm...
You, well, if you, you feel you... Huh?
There's a beautiful English model supposed to be here now named Gene Shrimpton.
Very good. I'm sorry about this, Miss Jean. Bennett does his homework, you know. Yeah. That's his trouble. Actually, Miss Jean, we could say with
So they're making inside jokes that you would have to know who these... That you have to know who these people are to get that, that Bennett serve as a brain, an intellectual, you know, all this kind of stuff. And they even make a joke about Twiggy, like, you know, things that would never be acceptable today. One of, I think it's Jack Jones or somebody says, boy, I sure like you, you're better than Twiggy because Twiggy's too skinny and all this kind of stuff. And you know, you know, from my vantage point is studying all this stuff and knowing about all these women and models. I love all of them because it's like, well, what? Varushka? I mean, I'm interested in all this stuff. And so, but, you know, again, you know, I have a kind of encyclopedic kind of a sensibility. And, you know, I think they're all interesting. But we want to see what, how, wait here. Trying to make clear.
Or, well, I guess that's the wrong way to put it. How many covers have you been on? Have you ever tried to keep count?
This is what they talk about.
No, I don't know for sure. Quite a lot.
Quite a lot?
Yes.
Well, that's very modest.
I think it's nice to note there's a great deal more of Miss Shrimpton than there was of Miss Twiggy when she was out there. And it's all to the good, too.
Not difficult, though, is it?
Well, I must say, we hope you're enjoying this visit. You've been to the United States before.
Oh, yes, quite a visit.
Hope you're enjoying this visit, and congratulations on the beginning of a movie career, and we hope that it takes you right up the top and you become one of the bright stars. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay. What have we got here? What are we doing?
I only know.
What are we doing? We got to get away from. That's good enough. It's not going to only. So, Peter F., thank you for coming. Yeah, Moss Hart, Act One is a great book. My dad had a first edition of Act One. I mean, my dad actually knew Bennett Cerf. It's a whole long. Peter's so nice to come in and talk about What's My Line. Yeah, it's great. I mean, again, we're doing a little different. We're analyzing cultural change and stuff. So, looking at that, what I just showed you, you might think, Mitch, what's the big deal? She's just a quiet, beautiful model that answers questions. Yeah, first edition. What's the revolution? And actually, I've watched that many times, and my friend was right. So Gene Shrimpton is like Jimi Hendrix, Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, even Jermaine Greer, maybe. Phil, you know, in this context, she's like a Molotov cocktail coming in there. She says, well, yes, this is what I do. But it's a different energy. It's a different, and her sensibility and the way she carries herself, her is, you know, I'm exaggerating, is washing away all of those folks, the Bennett Cerfs of the world and the Jack Jones she's the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and 67. So there is a shift, and she's, and there's more shifts later, like Emily Reschkowski writes memoirs about what it's like to be a model. A very good memoir, by the way. My Body's a really, really good book. Great book, actually. Which Gene Shrimpton never really did. And so evolution over time, you know, and then interest me. So what I've been kind of doing in these episodes, early episodes were episode 7, is trying to capture aspects of this world. The world of Bobby Short and Cole Porter and this TV show and Howard Hawks and Marilyn Monroe. And evidently, Howard Hawks and Marilyn Monroe have a long reach because they reach Greta Gerwig's consciousness, of course, as we all know, with I'm Just a Ken, which for me was the best part of the Oscars show. Brilliant, brilliant. But I'm often wondering, you know, somebody that doesn't know about Howard Hawks, hasn't seen Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, might not get all the, you know, maybe the subtlety or the depth and of that show from Barbie, that song from Barbie. Anyhow, I thought it'd be interesting to have all these books here. Don't know where to begin. What have we got? Okay. We're moving ahead about 10 years. Well, actually, yeah. We're heading into the 70s. And I thought it would be really fun to read an account, a candid account, of one of their creative artists of this era, this world. Jules Stein. I don't know. Because he wrote Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. He wrote Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. I mean, he wrote, you know, songs for this big movie that made Marilyn Monroe so famous, and which inspired an Oscar winning this year, Ryan Gosling and Greta Gerwig. So see, this is interesting. So there's artistic continuity. And so, well, there's also the Madonna did it with Material Girl, same thing. This like, but anyhow, it'd be interesting to see what, I have to get out my glasses and, there's so much to talk about. I don't know. So Jules Stein wrote Bells Are Ringing for Judy Holliday. He wrote so many movies and shows. For Daryl Zanuck. Oh, what have we got here? He wrote Gypsy. That was kind of, but I don't really know. I'm trying to find the excerpt. Ah, here we go. All right. Drum roll. Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, this movie, this song, was the first of your stage just to be filmed. And this is what Julie Stein says. He said, yes, but on the screen, it wasn't Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. It was a successful film because Marilyn and Jane Russell were so good in it. But it should be a period piece set in the 20s. They modernized it, and that made it wrong. So what Jules Stein says, he's already disappointed with what Hawks did and Zanuck did, because they set it in the 50s. And from Jules Stein's point of view, that ruins everything. It's got to be set in the 20s, you know. And so these things that audiences might think are minor, insignificant for him, or so he's, you know, he's up to, he says, this is a great movie. Howard Hawks is a great director. Jane Russell and Marilyn Monroe are terrific in it. Good songs that I wrote, if I should say so myself, he would say, but they ruin this one thing. So it's very complex when a work of art is made. Just like I said, somebody that's never heard of Marilyn Monroe and never seen Gentlemen Prefer Blondes will miss a lot of the I'm Just a Ken song. They will. They will not get, I mean, they could still enjoy it, but they'll miss a lot of the references and things. And also, you know, it's one example. But in this case, you know, Jules Stein is, you know, he's like, well, they ruined it. Why did they have to set it in the 50s? It's a little bit like the 70s, like much like the 50s and the 70s, they made everything 70s. So they had to, but anyhow, I just wanted to talk to you on. Marilyn Monroe was a very dear friend of mine. I coached her in all of her songs for the film. She was very fond of me. When I rehearsed, she'd come in sometimes between lunch hour and makeup for another film. And she'd make me place my piano against the wall so that I couldn't look at her. I'm not made up, she'd say. Don't look at me. And I don't want you to see me looking this way. So sweet. We used to go to parties, Gloria Vanderbilt and so on, where everyone did numbers. And she'd come over to me and say, ask me to sing. And she said, come on, Marilyn, sing. I'd say, well, I want to sing Bye Bye Baby, she'd say. She'd sit on my lap, and I swear every note had a dig of her handnail for me to keep time, like bye, bye. But, you know, it's a song. My wrists were almost bleeding when she got through. So he's the pianist. Julie Stein's great composer, lyricist, is having to play piano for Marilyn Monroe, and her nails are digging into him and making him bleed, but he didn't care because he's accompanying Marilyn Monroe at this party. So it's just interesting, right? What did he say? He said, I really liked her. I don't mean love, he says. Very few people liked her as well as I did. Now, here's the tragedy. I got an idea and called Richard Zanuck, who was later head of the studio. I says, I've got a great idea for a movie musical. I want to do A Tree Grows in Brooklyn with Frank Sinatra in the Jimmy Dunn part, and Marilyn Monroe is the girl. An idea. We won't make her a woman who scrubs floors, but find other hardships for her with the baby, and it'll be a dramatic role. Then I called Marilyn. Says, Marilyn, you mean you don't have a secretary? Answer your phone. Who is this? This is Jules Stein calling from New York. Now listen carefully if you're distracted or doing something. I'm all alone. I'm glad you called, she said. Listen, Marilyn, I got this idea. You and Sinatra, Tree Grows in Brooklyn. She said, it sounds exciting. I'll be in New York on Monday at the Sherry Netherlands Hotel. Call there and leave your number, and I'll call as soon as I get in. Have you spoken to Frank? No, darling, because I'm calling you first. You said yes, and then I'll call Frank. So Jules Stein is going to the stars first. He's going to Marilyn Monroe. He's going to Frank Sinatra. These are his colleagues, the artists. He's not going, in other words, he's saying, if I could get, I guess the idea is if I can get Marilyn Monroe and get Frank Sinatra, and they'll say yes, but as he finds out, you know, you can have yes for the, you know, it's interesting, right? So she said, well, we'll find somebody else. He can't do it. And, Jesus, sounds great. I called you first, Frank. What if she doesn't want to do it? And then Sinatra says, "I will get some other broad," is what he says. And I called Dick Zanuck and said, I have them both. That Sunday, Marilyn Monroe died. So that would have been, what, 66? Yeah. So it was really because of Marilyn Monroe dying that Tree Grows in Brooklyn musical by Jules Stein never became a thing. So this stuff gets into Hollywood. This is the old Hollywood. This is the old, you know, it's the Hollywood we look. It's this, you know. Here you go. It's this. There we go. 1953. That's why this show, it's weird. We're in 67, but it's almost like Woodstock ain't happening, and there's no folk scene, and there's no Dylan. It's like from 10 years behind, you know, except for Gene Shrimpton, who comes in like an avalanche, comes in with her energy, her under the surface explosive energy in that. So it's interesting to think about eras having different characteristics and qualities, you know. And I'm just going to hear this account from Jules Stein. And I think we should conclude with some Susan Sontag, because she's we've neglected her recently. And I think it replies to what we're talking about. She's talking about style, right? So here she says, "The work of art, so far as we give ourselves to it, exercises a total or absolute claim on us. The purpose of art is not as an auxiliary to truth, either particular and historic or eternal. If art is anything, as Rob Guerrier has written, it is everything." So if art is anything, it's everything. "In which case it must be self-sufficient, and there could be nothing beyond it." This position is easily caricatured, for we live in the world, and it is in the world that objects of art are made and enjoyed. The claim that I have been making for the autonomy of the work of art, its freedom to mean, it's in quotes, scare quotes, mean nothing, does not rule out consideration of the effect or impact or function of art, once it be granted that in this functioning of the art object, as art object, the divorce between the aesthetic and the ethical is meaningless. I have several times applied to the work of art the metaphor of a mode of nourishment. To become involved with the work of art entails, to be sure, the experience of detaching oneself from the world. So in other words, to deal with art, at least on one level, you gotta detach from personal biography, the world, in part, not entirely, but just what she says by that. Detach from the world. But the work of art itself is also a vibrant, magical, and exemplary object which returns us to the world in some way more open and enrich. So it's like a two-step. It's like you forget yourself, your ego, your own parochial, provincial interests, you know. And then maybe they'll come back in later. You return to those interests, maybe. But the hope is that those interests won't just be interests. It won't just be narrow, you know, kind of expand and then becomes the world. And that's the goal, that's the hope. So I was going to play all these little things here, but I realize now, I mean, I don't even know, you know,
but I prefer a man
because
who lives and gives expensive jewels. A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend. A kiss may be grand, but it won't pay the rental on your humble flat, or help you at the automat. Mail will call.
So she says that, you know, the lyrics are, it won't help you at the automat. You know, this kind of, I mean, you got Madonna's interpretation. But I'm going to turn this TV off. You get the picture. If you know Barbie, you know Greta Gerwig's. It's really complex what she does, because it's not parody. It's deep respect and love for Howard Hawks' film. See, that's what I like. You know, in other words, I can see so many artists that don't like musicals or are really clueless about Marilyn Monroe, and what they would have done would have been terrible. So she's making jokes about male ego, of course, I'm just a can, and, you know, topical things about that. But it's so well done, because it's that combination of her knowledge of those films and everything. And also wanting to say something about being a man or a woman or trans or having an identity or being a human today. And I applaud her for doing that, how she does it in that song. It's also great to see musical dumpers like that, that someone did that. No one really does it that much. And, you know. So I've read Sontag saying that the art is really the whole world. And I think that's a good place to stop. There's many things I want to tackle and talk about in future episodes, but I just want to hang out here in this era. I want to hang out with these retro, pre-rock and roll, pre-folk rock, pre-modern, I mean, it's modern, but pre-contemporary things a little bit, just because, I don't know, it's important and people might not know it as well. So I'll come back to Jewel Stein and Cy Coleman and things like that. So... So thank you, and we will continue talking about old Hollywood. We're gonna. I won't spend forever here. I promise. I'll get to some more contemporary things. Well, I did in this episode. I talked about a song from the movie Barbie. That's, you can't get more topical than that. But that film is interested in this stuff a little bit, doing something with it, which. So thank you. Have a great weekend, whatever you celebrate. And we're going to next commence with Hannah Arendt's Life of the Mind, Thinking. So see you then.